Hi, this is Adam Levin, and I am on something of a balcony in Chicago. I'm going to read this is my story, considering the bittersweet end of Susan Falls. It starts with chapter 130,020, Dreams About Flying. Susan Falls hates the flying dreams. She wakes up and she can't walk, which is beside the point. She can't walk when she wakes from non-flying dreams either. The flying dreams speak of an unconscious obsession with walking, her therapist tells her. The therapist tells her about the stages of death and dying, harping mostly on the denial stage. What the rest of the stages are isn't important. What is important is that when the therapist tells her about the stages, he does so, he says, because he does not think the loss of Susan's legs has been properly mourned. To Susan, this is nonsense. She lost her legs as a baby in the jungle, to gangrene, after the leopard bit her. So she'd never really had them to begin with. At least not long enough to require her to mourn their loss. Besides, what upsets her isn't that she can't walk, but that she has dreams which would seem to suggest that somewhere deep inside she wants to walk, when nowhere non-deep inside does she. And tacky dreams at that. The flying is always travel channel scenic. Susan soaring over the ocean or the mountains, between skyscrapers with puffy cloud reflections on their windows. It might be different, might point to something real or individual about Susan if she flew over the Gaza Strip or post-NATO Belgrade, Mazar-i Sharif. She never dreams of what she wants to, though, no matter how hard she thinks about whatever that might be before she goes to sleep. Last night, for instance, she thought of Carlo Ribisi's ass for nearly an hour and ended up cruising over the Grand Canyon at 4,000 feet. Chapter 130,021. The accident, pretty to think so. Susan and her mother are in the all-white kitchen, drinking orange juice, waiting for Susan's father to come downstairs before eating the egg dish that Giselle, the distant cousin who came to America to be an au pair but could not find a job as an au pair and so has become the cook his maid. Giselle is on the balcony, smoking cigarettes. "You don't look so good today, Suze," Susan's mother says. "Bad dreams?" Susan nods, staring through the glass table at the glass table's frosted glass base. Where the kitchen is not white, it is mirrored, and if she looks up, she risks being confronted with a vision of herself. And no one wants that in the morning, let alone Susan Falls. "Was it about the accident again?" says Susan's mother. Susan shuts her eyes with a force that, had she any magic in her, would be large enough to knock the whole penthouse into orbit. Susan's mother likes to talk about the accident. She likes to say Susan would do well to talk about the accident herself. She says it to everyone. "I asked if you dreamt of the accident," says Susan's mother. "The accident," says Susan? "How could I remember the accident well enough to dream about it anyway?" "Now don't what?" says Susan. "Don't mention your lackluster mothering style, your irresponsibility. Don't question the sanity and goodness of a woman who'd not only leave her baby on a jungle floor, but let the wound she suffered by the leopard's fangs fester and..." "Oh, the leopard, isn't it pretty to think so," Susan's mother says. Susan's mother sneezes angrily and screams for Susan's father. Susan's father, dressed in beige suit pants with braces half-braced, his untucked U-shirt hem flapping by the belt line, thumps down the spiral stairway and runs into the kitchen. "What is it? What's happened?" "She's talking about leopards again. Oh my God." "Forget it," Susan says. "Forget it." "Susan, do you need to go back to the hospital?" Susan's father says. "You're still in the denial stage," Susan tells her father. "Dr. Fleem told me to expect that from you, but what I want to know is, what about me? What about me?" "Damn that Fleem," Susan's mother says, and to her father, "call the Medicar." "Francis, just hold your horses for just a second here, honey." Susan's father pulls a cigar from somewhere in his pants and fondles it against the beam of a mean halogen bulb. He says, "Now, Susan, what was it you were saying? Something about leopards?" "No, nothing," Susan says. "I wasn't saying anything about leopards." "How did you lose your legs, Susan?" Susan's father says. Susan is crying. Her mother is staring at her. Her mother looks like a bug, and Susan does not want to one day look like her mother. "A car," Susan says. The egg dish that Giselle made is getting cold, and it looks very good, too. Very tasty. Last night, Giselle told Susan that she'd been formulating this egg recipe, experimenting, taste-testing for months, and that it had become perfect, that there was not a similar egg dish all the world round, and even so much as the appeal of eggs for breakfast tended to be their banality, and that novelty when it came to egg dishes was generally frowned upon by the breakfast industry. The dish was delicious. Last night, Giselle told Susan that, in her most private thoughts, she called the thing Giselle's delicious egg dish, and that in some other of her private thoughts, which were not as private as those aforementioned, she had something of a dream as of late, and in some, the dream was of Giselle's delicious egg dish becoming vastly popular over the next 20 years, worldwide popular, and thereby eventually becoming just another banal egg dish. Once common, the not as private thought went, its name would be shortened, simplified, to Eggs Giselle. After she'd revealed all of this to Susan, Giselle said that she knew it sounded silly and ponyback girlish, but what of it, right? To which Susan agreed. And now it was getting cold, Giselle's delicious egg dish. The auburn-tinged glaze on the whites was becoming a filmy gel. She's only just saying it, Susan's mother says. She doesn't really mean it. She's only just saying it. Now, Francis. Susan, tell us more. You said a car. What about a car? I was playing in the street with Pedro, and a car hit us, and I lost my legs. How old were you? It was last year. How old were you, Susan, was the question. I was 13 when the car hit me. I turned 14 the day they hacked off my legs. Who hacked them off? The doctors. Where did the doctors hack your legs off? In the bungalow. Susan's mother says. My legs were infected, Mom, and after lightly anesthetizing me with an orally administered paste of rum and pulverized valerian root, the doctors, as you like to call them, chopped off my legs with their machetes in the bungalow. Medicar. Just kidding, Susan says. It was at Children's Memorial. Liar. You're lying. You don't believe what you just said. I need to go to school now, Susan says. You need to go back to high school, young lady. I hate high school. High school was the most glorious time of your life. I need to go to school. Not until... Please, Mommy. I'm sorry. I love you. You didn't leave me to the teeth of that dastardly leopard. Please, let's just eat our eggs Giselle and get on with the day. Eggs Giselle. Did you hear that, Francis? She sure can turn a phrase, Mike. Can't she, our girl, Susan? Little smarty pants. How much do you love Mommy? This much. Chapter 130,022. Midrash in the morning. Nowhere deep inside does she. Susan has the duration of the ride to campus to do yesterday's assignment for Media Studies 761, Consuming God. She takes Genesis Rabbah, a book of Midrash, from her bag, and writes in the margins of a story about God and Adam that her professor has asked her to present to the class this afternoon. He wants her to frame it as the first ever buyer empowerment scheme. The story. Before there was an Eve, Adam was lonely and bored and sad, and to fascinate him, God revealed the future of the world, taking care as he did so to remove all episodes that would occur within the span of Adam's lifetime. Though God's plan worked at first, Adam eventually grew distracted by his loneliness again. God reconsidered showing Adam Adam's own future life, but judged for the second and final time that doing so would be a grave misstep, and instead chose to try his hand at improvisation. Rather than continuing to show Adam what would be, God showed him what could be, were one event that was slated to occur one way to instead occur another way. The story of David, who slew Goliath, loved Bathsheba, and as its strongest king made of Israel an empire, was particularly moving to Adam, despite his knowledge that it was only a could-be, that David would, as originally foretold by God, die at birth. Only a few words into the Psalms, which God had spelled out for him in clouds, Adam found himself weeping at the thought that David would never write them, and he transferred 70 years of his allotted 1,000 to David, so that David would survive beyond birth and do everything that, before the transfer, he only could have done. What Susan believes. Adam gave life to David out of love for David. What Susan would like to believe. Adam gave life to David out of love for the world. Gave David life so that the world would not be deprived of David. What she is being asked by her professor to spin. Adam gave life to David out of love for Adam. Being that Adam was the first man, Susan plans to tell the class, all men would be of him. And being that Israel, during the Davidic era, would be the greatest community of all men, Davidic era Israel would be the greatest achievement to come of Adam's creation. Susan would say that Adam,
if
as he
I allow
read the
that
Psalms
Adam
in the
was
sky,
able to transfer
was not moved as much by their
life
beauty
to David,
as by how their beauty would affect his legacy.
Then I should probably allow that he was able to
she would
transfer
say
more,
that Adam wept at
to.
The possibility that his
and
legacy
if for the
could
sake
be
of
so
argument,
glorious,
I allow
yet
that
wouldn't
investing
be so
80
glorious
years
if he failed
David
to take
rather
action.
Than 70
she
would
quit,
have further glorified
and therefore,
Adam's legacy.
Adam's giving of life would be better described as spending,
why Adam didn't relinquish
and better yet
those
as
extra 10 years,
for its purpose was to ensure
of his own time on earth.
If the
maybe
class
because
was with
Adam
her,
knew
they
the extra
were.
Glory supplied
she
wouldn't really
to
pay
close
off.
With a joke about
what would that
the
imply?
Intricacies of calculating
that even
a
relatively
time lost
small
to glory
bit
increased
of life
ratio.
On earth, 1%
with or without the joke,
can
she was confident
by a
she would get
certain calculable quotient.
What Susan
with more
is
than a higher quality
credit,
of already assured immortality.
How Adam, who was born a man,
that Adam
and
kept
without
the extra
Eve,
10 years
without knowing
the
he was a male and a male female dichotomy, and so knowing nothing of human reproduction,
itself,
could know that other
too
men would come from him, rather than the word of God, where Adam had come from.
Except
As the limo exits the drive at 57th, Susan sets the extra credit aside for later consideration and rereads her marginalia. While doing so, she's struck by the idea that Adam might be a lot like her. His 70 years, her lower body, David, her brain. Sometime early on, when she knew things in a pure sense, she might have made a deal with God, an investment of her earthly legs in a transcendent mind with high capacity.
And if I allow that, I should also allow that the extra 1% could have been detrimental.
So pretty, in fact, that she doesn't realize the limo is stopped.
Maybe if you stick around for too long after
you Jake, the driver,
retroactively lessen the importance
and pronounces her name.
Effect of what you did
Susan,
before
says,
and during
are you not well? Would
maybe
like
Adam
me
knew that
class
if David
today?
Lived past 70, David would have, either by means of wrongdoing or even simple inefficacy, besmirched the memories others would have of him after his death, thereby marring any reflections that would be cast on his earlier accomplishments, which would leave him less cherished overall, and finally decrease the sum of the glory he'd have otherwise added to Adam's legacy. So then David was made to die when he did in order to save his and Adam's story from being sullied? Too ugly not to think so?
Chapter 130 and 23. Considering the Utility of Blue Snowpants. Susan Falls thinks Carla Ribisi has a big ass, and that Carla Ribisi's big ass is beautiful, and that Carla does not know it. And Carla Ribisi is always wearing blue nylon snow pants. The intended effect of the snow pants is to disguise the bigness of the ass in biggerness. Susan Falls thinks, it is a complicated trick. It begins with a syllogism. The first premise is that anyone who wears snow pants appears to have a big ass. The second premise is that Carla Ribisi wears snow pants. The conclusion is that Carla Ribisi appears to have a big ass. The trick comes of the word appears. Appears allows for, but does not necessitate visual trickery. Things that allow for, but do not necessitate other things are tricky. And tricky things engender consideration. Things that allow for, but do not necessitate trickery itself are even trickier. And these things engender much richer consideration. The richer the consideration engendered by a thing, the longer the time one will spend considering that thing. Consider the following hypothetical situation. Susan Falls has just started dating Carla Ribisi, and the two go shopping together for what will soon become another item of Carla Ribisi's laundry. A new t-shirt, for instance. They go into the changing room together, and Carla tries on one of the two low-cut V-neck stretchy t-shirts she's thinking about buying. Say a red one, a warm red, like that of the hair under Susan's arms. The t-shirt looks good, and Susan Falls tells Carla Ribisi that the t-shirt looks good. Carla tells Susan Falls that this is the first time she's shared a changing room with another woman since the long-lost days when she used to shop at indoor malls with her mother. Susan Falls blushes. Carla Ribisi removes t-shirt number one and, reaching for t-shirt number two, looks at Susan Falls, perhaps longingly, and says, "Blusher." Being called on blushing causes dollar coin-sized spots of the same shade of blush as Susan Falls' face to appear on Susan Falls' neck. Carla Ribisi pulls her head up through t-shirt number two. "I'm sorry," she says to Susan Falls. "I didn't mean to make you embarrassed when I said that you were a blusher." The dollar coins darken in time with Susan's ecstasy. Susan's ecstasy is like neither a balloon nor a hat pin, but like a hat pin's entrance and movement under guidance of a cotton-gloved birthday clown through the skin of a balloon. There is something that is so goddamned hot about Carla Ribisi considering and further discussing any effect which she has had on Susan Falls, let alone in a Nordstrom dressing room, trying on t-shirts. T-shirt number two looks good, but in a different way than the way in which t-shirt number one looked good. "So?" Carla wants to know. "It looks good," Susan says. "It makes your tits look bigger." "Hmm." Carla doesn't know if she likes that. She has big enough looking tits already. Showing them off, she has decided, at different times in her past, makes her look like a floozy. "That's good," she says, "that it makes my tits look bigger?" "You have beautiful tits, Carla. The t-shirt just brings it out." "Do you mean to say that my tits are essentially beautiful, and that the appearance of more of my tits reveals more essential beauty?" "Yes," Susan says, now thrilled to damp under things by Carla's obsessive parsing and analysis of a sentence Susan has spoken. "Or do you mean to say," Carla says, "that my tits are beautiful because they are big, and therefore my tits, upon looking bigger, appear more beautiful, as you can't get enough of a good thing? The good thing being the bigness of tits." "Are you making fun of me?" Susan says. "Not at all," says Carla. "I'm having fun with you, and attempting to choose between t-shirts at the same time. So which shirt's better?" I don't know that we can make informed choices about the t-shirts at this point, says Susan, because now that we've spent so much more time on the one you're wearing than we did on the first one, we're probably invested in the one you're wearing, and... I'm not going to sweat that, Susan. Which one do you like better? My opinion... Your opinion isn't founded on a bedrock of rigorous analysis, and therefore, etc., 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 says Carla. You are making fun of me, says Susan. I'm telling you that I want and will buy the t-shirt that you prefer, Carla says. Are you sure? Because you're saying it in this way that it sounds like maybe you're making fun of me. Susan Falls begins to shiver, and then she begins to cry. Not really, but hypothetically. Susan's hypotheticals often end up sadly, and hardly ever make their point with force. Disregarding the ever-present effect that the wheelchair factor has on her self-esteem, the sadly ending hypothetical factor is the number one reason for why she can't bring herself to engage Carla Ribisi in conversation. But back to trickery. The considerer will arrive at two interpretations of Carla Ribisi appears to have a big ass, each one implicated by the other. A. The actual size of Carla Ribisi's ass cannot be known at this juncture, snow-pantsed. And B. Carla Ribisi's ass is a mystery. Susan Falls has by now watched enough TV and studied enough social and cognitive psychology, she hopes, to soon fulfill her dream of becoming one half of a powerful and revered creative team at Leo Burnett. Susan knows about attribution. She knows self-perception theory. Susan knows that for any given considerer, there is an unknown amount of time, designated X, that must be spent considering a thing before the considerer becomes aware that she has spent time considering the thing. Susan knows that after X amount of time has been spent considering an as yet neutral or unbalanced thing, and the considerer has thereby become aware of the time spent considering the thing will appear to the considerer to be worth the considerer's time. Susan knows that the considerer, unless she is one who suffers from terribly low self-esteem or clinical depression, believes that things that are worth her time are necessarily good things. For the considerer knows she would not waste her time on bad things. That by these cognitive means, the considered thing becomes a good or positively balanced thing. Therefore, once the mystery of Carla Ribisi's ass has been considered for X amount of time, the mystery of Carla Ribisi's ass is good. And all good mysteries are good to solve, so solving the mystery is good. In order to solve the mystery, in order to see Carla Ribisi sans blue snow pants, one would have to spend time with Carla Ribisi, time enough to get to places where wearing snow pants would be out of the question, swimming pools, dressing rooms, etc. If Carla is a smarty, and Susan is sure that Carla must be, for Susan wouldn't otherwise waste so much time gawking at and thinking about her, then Carla, to ensure the given considerer's X be arrived at or surpassed, would stretch out this getting-to-know-Carla time for as long as possible before letting the considerer see her without snow pants. In being kept from seeing what Susan will call Carla's true ass for X amount of time or longer, the considerer, always considering, will work the previously outlined self-perception algorithm. But this time, the considerer will transpose solving the mystery with true ass itself. Now, not only has to solve become a good thing, but true ass, the solution, has become good. If Susan Falls were to write successful commercials for Carla Ribisi's ass, the only two things she would have to figure out would be 1, how much time X equals for the average person, and 2, how to make the commercial compelling enough to keep the viewer thinking about it for greater than or equal to X amount of time. If the considerer ever had a preference, for example, likes big asses, likes small asses, likes jacked up small asses that look bigger than they are, and most considerers do begin with a preference, then this preference will, by way of the above-described process, become irrelevant. While pursuing true ass, the considerer comes to prefer true ass. In other words, any ass worth spending greater than or equal to X amount of time on is good ass. Chapter 130,024, An Acceptance Speech. The other brilliant aspect about Carla Ribisi's blue snow pants is the sound they make when Carla enters a packed lecture hall, tardy, as she has just now. Except people in college are never called tardy. The tardy go to high school. In college they're late, and this is the sort of thing, this usage of tardy, that Susan Falls wouldn't want to betray to Carla Ribisi upon their first actual meeting, but might come in handy later on, when Susan decides it's time to coyly let Carla know something that she wants the whole world to know. Susan wants the whole world to know that she is a 15-year-old freshman in college. But she doesn't want the world to know that she wants the world to know. She wants the world to see her as the sort of person who would not only make light of such an achievement on her part in conversation, but the sort of person who would really not consider it an achievement. She has a statement prepared, an explanation of her being a 15-year-old freshman in college, and she hopes that the topic will come up so that one day soon she can make the statement. This is the statement. Ah, well, when you're legless, no one wants to play with you, and TV gets boring fast, so all you have are books and time. Chapter 130,025, Shika Shika, A Glimpse at Death. Carla Ribisi enters the packed lecture hall, late for Logic 1, an introduction to propositional logic. Her snow pants make the snow pants sound. For all of those present, the sound is the seed of the tree of uncountable self-perceptions relating to Carla, and three strides in, she sees them all watching her, the professor included. He's clearing his throat, over and over. Instead of making her way to her usual desk at the back of the lecture hall, she considerately heads to the nearest open seat, which is in the front row, between a deaf boy, in front of whom crouches an interpreter, whose frantic signing distracts all hell out of the ASL-fluent Susan Falls, and Susan Falls, in front of whom is a wheelchair. The interpreter signs, "Lecture interrupted by noise, S-H-I-K-K-A, S-H-I-K-K-A," and Susan's mind twirls at the thought of signing sound for a deaf boy, at the thought of a deaf boy reading a sign for a sound. At what must be the sameness, to a deaf boy, of a sign for a sound and the sound the sign stands for, as if a sound were nothing more than the sign that stands for it. Susan Falls shivers, like in the Nordstrom dressing room, but not hypothetically. Carla Ribisi, while getting settled, inadvertently knocks loose the brake on Susan Falls' wheelchair. The wheelchair rolls down the moderately sloped floor of the lecture hall. "Oh God," whispers Carla Ribisi. And Susan's shivering body starts to shake. Only with her mind still twirling, it's as if it isn't Susan's field of vision that's trembling, but that which is in her field of vision. The shaking of Susan's body seems to be the shaking of the classroom, and although a part of her knows that it's her body shaking, although a part of her knows from experience that classrooms don't shake, the shaking of her body, rather than being expressed by the words, "My body is shaking," words she hears in the ear of her mind, seem to be the expression of the words, "My body is shaking." And no part of her knows otherwise, not from experience. And the thought of this makes her shake harder. And harder, until the rolling wheelchair strikes the wall beneath the tray of the chalkboard and clatters, and Susan startles out of her twirl. "Stop shaking. Ideas don't startle," is what she tells herself. "They don't shake. Names can't shiver," she thinks. "The world is not just a word with an L. Everything is fine. The twirl is an outcome of low blood sugar, is all. Look at things," Susan thinks. "Look at the wheelchair." The wheelchair, having struck the wall, rolls back a few inches, as if the wall had struck it back, thus describing Newton's second law of motion. Rather, demonstrating Newton's second law of motion. Or rather, demonstrating the effect of Newton's second law of motion. For the wheelchair doesn't do the demonstrating, does it? The motion of the wheelchair does the demonstrating. Newton's second law of motion, which is the name of a principle described by Newton, explains why the wheelchair describes the motion that it describes after striking the wall. And a shiver comes on. Better to look at Carla, Susan thinks. "Oh God," Carla says, "oh no." The shiver wavers, quits. Susan never got to eat her breakfast is all. Her eggs just sell, she tells herself. And to quell the last tiny remnant of her panic, she inhales deep, slows her blood down. What Carla hears is mounting rage. "Oh my God," Carla Ribisi says once more. "I'm really so sorry." "It's okay, Carla," says Susan. And all her panic is gone. "It's just God. I mean, it's just that..." "Carla," Susan says, "I hate today. Anything I do is wrong," Carla says. Tears tremble in the scoops of Carla's eyelashes. One falls, splats against the thumbnail the color of a robin's egg, is atomized. More follow. Everyone in the classroom continues to watch Carla Ribisi, even the professor. To defend Carla, Susan Falls glares at anyone who thinks she's strong enough to stand Susan's eye contact. It is a sacrifice. Susan wants to watch Carla cry also. "Let's leave," Susan says. "Really?" Carla wipes snot on the arm of the matching blue parka that she hasn't yet removed. The parka's shell is a shiny kind of nylon, iridescent, and the snot is clear and perfectly straight, like some 3-inch pinstripe. It performs miracles of refraction with the fluorescent light particles that fall through the grids of the ceiling panels. Now Carla leans in close and whispers, "But..." And then she sees the line of snot. "God, that's gross. I'm so gross." She snorts a giggle. "But what?" Susan Falls says. "How will we get out of here?" Still whispering, Carla says. "Just pull my chair over and we'll go," says Susan. "Everyone will see." "Fuck them," says Susan Falls. This is the first time in her entire life that she has employed an extra-cerebral profanity. Though in fantasy, she has often used swear words. She has never spoken one. It feels good, and it occurs to Susan that as stupid as most people sound when they use profanities, as stupid as she must have sounded just now, the feeling of power that just rushed through her, from inner labia to thyroglossal duct, the trace sensations left over from just now when she said the word fuck, make sounding stupid more than worthwhile. Fuck them then, Carla Rubisi agrees, and it is the hottest motherfucking thing Susan has ever heard. Chapter 130,026, Two Bounces in Logic. Carla, throwing over the intricacies of the original plan, crouches in front of Susan and, at the sign language interpreter who is staring at her, makes this sound. Ch. Hook your arms around my neck, Carla says. Really? Susan says. But she's hardly gotten it out before she's in midair, her stumped thighs at Carla's soft sides under her unzipped parka. It is two steps to the wheelchair, and so two bounces, from which Susan deduces that the thing rubbing against her is a navel piercing. Okay, says Carla. With one arm, she turns the wheelchair around, then lowers Susan into it, slowly, their belly buttons meeting for a sliver of a second. Do you need me to push you? Not at all, Susan says. She follows Carla out of the lecture hall. Nice knowing you, lady, says the professor. Chapter 130,027, In the Hallway Outside of Logic. That guy's such an asshole, Carla says. He just wants to fuck you, says Susan. I think maybe he wants to fuck you, Carla says. Susan's first impulse is to insist that what Carla has just said is not true at all. Instead, she says, he probably wants to fuck us both simultaneously. If he had it his way, he'd have us from behind, have us each bent over his office desk. He'd slide his dick in and out of your pussy, so he could watch your beautiful ass twitch beneath his sloppy thrusting, and he'd keep his unclipped fingers rhythmlessly whittling away at me, so as not to obstruct the freak show view of my lower half. Carla gasps and does a cat stretch. That made me tingle what you just said, she says. What's your name? I'm Susan Falls. That's a pretty name. You want to go somewhere and get really fucked up? I have my Moderns in Paris seminar in an hour, but fuck it. I was born to get really fucked up with you, Carla. Chapter 130,028. A dance, a damn good time together. Carla rents a second-story room from a professor of music on 59th Street, just east of Ellis Avenue. The home is a standardly professorial Victorian, rampless. Carla wheels Susan through the alley and up to the garage. Punching out the command code on the number pad, Carla bounces a little and turns her head to smile at Susan, twice. That's my Alibaba dance, she says. The garage door opens. Have you ever smoked opium? Susan considers telling a lie, but chooses not to. No, never. Good, Carla says. She wheels Susan into a corner of the garage and crouches down in front of the chair, the tips of her ponytail touching Susan's half lap. Wrap around me, Carla says. Susan obeys, lets her hands fall where they may on Carla's chest. Carla stands up. You're strong, Carla. How'd you get so strong? I speed skate. Rather than remarking on any number of the positive effects that she imagines speed skating must surely have on the ass of Carla, Susan utters a simple wow. But her face is pressed against Carla's face, and she feels Carla's face get hot, as if Susan had remarked on the effects of speed skating. Susan likes that. Carla brings Susan up the stairs to her room. There aren't any chairs. Where do you want to be? The bed's fine, says Susan. If you can get me somewhere near the headboard so I could lean, she is saying. But Carla is already getting her somewhere near the headboard so she can lean. Good? Good, says Susan. How old are you, Susan? What? You seem older than most freshmen. Actually, I'm 15, says Susan. Wow, you're like one of these genius kids who basically skips high school, aren't you? Ah, well, when you're legless, that's really hot, Susan, Carla interrupts. Chapter 130,029, Opium. It doesn't matter that the opium came as a gift from Dan Batner, this totally evil ex-boyfriend whom Carla had met in an MBA mixer at which she'd accidentally arrived last semester. It doesn't matter that he gave it to her last week. His reason for giving it to her, to let her know that had she not decided he was such an evil young man and then told him to stay away from her, she could have still been with the only opium dealer on campus and likely the only opium dealer in the tri-state area had she not been so cold, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter either that the opium is not opium, but rather nopium, an incense that Dan Batner mail-ordered for $19.99 per 40-ounce brick off an ad in the back of a glossy head magazine. Nor does it matter that the black brick of nopium isn't crumbly slash gummy in the same way that opium is crumbly slash gummy. Doesn't matter because any underclassman at the U of C who'd have researched opium's texture on the internet, no U of C underclassman had ever had opium in hand, would have only found words such as crumbly slash gummy to describe opium's texture, and words like crumbly slash gummy could really mean anything within reason if you thought about it hard enough anyway. Plus, nopium smells like real opium, which is a smell that anyone, anywhere in the world can become familiar with, as Carla and Susan have by watching The Wizard of Oz, and imagining the smell Dorothy smelled when she fell into stupor asleep in the field of poppies when the Wicked Witch of the West said, "Poppies, poppies," and caressed the crystal ball with long-nailed and delicately fingered green hands while winged monkeys cheeped and yapped and giggled. It doesn't matter that Susan and Carla are smoking incense out of Carla's color-morphing glass pipe, because even if it were real opium, the kind that would not only cause the neuronal axes in the user's brain to confuse opium molecules for in-house manufactured and transmitted opioid molecules, thus leading to the release of endogenous dopamine molecules, whose effect would be to feed back and prevent the transmitted opioid molecules from being re-uptaken, which would feed forward and inhibit the dopamine payload from being re-uptaken after it had been transmitted, thereby leaving the dopamine to pile up for hours on the user's neuronal axes undisturbed. Susan's not inhaling it. She doesn't know how. Inhaling versus not inhaling is not a dichotomy she is aware of. And even if she were inhaling real opium, it wouldn't matter, because it is not the drug, but the shared will to use the drug, to share the mouthpiece of a pipe, and to ditch class together and drag ass across campus to Carla's room, which smells like Carla's hair, like apple and girl, that matters. The undone inertia of unlikely emotion-laden circumstance, of tears and knocked-loose wheelchair brakes, riding on the sound of blue nylon snow-pant legs rubbing one another, is what matters. "I'm so high, Carla," Susan Falls says. "So am I," Carla says. They're stretched out on Carla's double bed next to one another. "Since we're both so high," she says, "let's pretend we're not." "As you wish. You know, your room smells so good," says Susan. "Doesn't it?" "Hey, Carla, I've been meaning to ask you, what's your major?" "I'm undecided." "What between, Carla?" "Between psychology and dropping out of college. I like the way you say my name all the time, Susan." "I think I want to drop out, too. Do you ever take those things off?" Carla giggles. "Do you?" Susan says. "You coming on to me, little girl?" "I've never come on to anyone before," says Susan. "You want me to take them off?" Chapter 130,030, A Leopard. 10 seconds later, Susan says, "No, not yet. Leave them on for a little while." "Do you smoke cigarettes, Susan?" Carla pulls a pack of Marlboros from a secret pocket inside her snow pants. "Here, smoke this cigarette with me and tell me how you lost your legs." Susan drags on the cigarette, but as with the opium, does not inhale. She says, "I'll tell you, Carla." "Tell me," says Carla. "It was a leopard," says Susan. "A leopard bit my legs in the jungle when I was an infant. I was lucky to survive. Gangrene set in, though, and they had to hack off my legs with a machete to prevent it from spreading." "A leopard?" Carla says. "You making fun of me?" "Not at all," says Susan. "And I was an infant, so it wasn't so much the leopard or the gangrene, I guess. An infant can't watch out for..." "Not to interrupt or be crude or anything," says Carla, "but this question just popped into my head. Or maybe not. Maybe it's been in my head for a while, since, because, you know, of what you said earlier about the desk and everything, and us being high, even though we're pretending not to be high, maybe provides me the space or excuse or whatever you want to call it to ask you this question. But are the workings of... Rather, can you..." Carla is blushing. "Blusher," says Susan. "Does yours?" says Carla. "Yes, and I call it my naz-naz, which is Farsi. What do you call yours?" says Susan. Carla kisses her knuckles smackingly. "Tell me about your leopard," she says. "It might have been a car," says Susan. "I don't know. Sometimes I think it was a car, and that's what everyone tries to tell me, but I tend to doubt it was a car." "Why would they tell you it was a car if it wasn't a car?" asks Carla. "Any number of reasons. Maybe they do it for my benefit, or maybe for my mother's. If it was a car, then according to them, I was trying to save my box turtle, Pedro, who I'd brought outside to play with, from being run over by the car. But I know otherwise. I know that if it was really a car, it was because Pedro was crushed, either accidentally or on purpose, while I tested the strength of his shell beneath the wheels of my mountain bike, and that Pedro's death destroyed my will to live, so I threw myself into oncoming traffic with suicidal intent. That's too ugly, though. So they say that I fell into the street while trying to save Pedro from being crushed by a car, because that way, accidental circumstance, rather than I, can be blamed for my state of leglessness. That's how the lie would benefit me. As well, it serves my mother on a couple levels. No mother can be expected to keep an eye on her 13-year-old daughter at all times, let alone control the pathway of a wayward box turtle or an oncoming car. However, a mother can and is expected both to keep her infant daughter off the floor of a jungle where hungry leopards live, and to raise such a daughter not to have suicidal ideations at the age of 13, see? Well, so wait, Carla says. Do you have any memories of walking? I have millions of memories of walking, says Susan. But I also have memories of dreams, of flying. Those were dreams, though, says Carla. But they feel similar enough, dreams and memories, that it wouldn't be rigorous to trust the distinction, Susan says. What about photographs? You can doctor those things, says Susan. It's all beside the point anyway. I'm legless. Hopefully I make up for it with brains. You make up for it by a long shot, whispers Carla. She's leaning over, separating Susan's bangs with her thumbs. Does your fancy brain make it up to you, though, she says. Without my fancy brain, I wouldn't be here right now, Susan says. Here where, says Carla. Here, let alone right here. That's someone's phone. Someone's phone's a-ringing. I believe it's the phone of the person whose balcony we are on. Don't know what to do. Should I touch the phone and make it stop ringing? Keeps ringing. Hopefully that voicemail beep won't keep beeping. We'll go back. Those were dreams, though, says Carla. But they feel similar enough, dreams and memories, says Susan, that it wouldn't be rigorous to trust the distinction. What about photographs? You can doctor those things, says Susan. It's all beside the point anyway. I'm legless. Hopefully I make up for it with brains. You make up for it by a long shot, whispers Carla. She's leaning over, separating Susan's bangs with her thumbs. Does your fancy brain make it up to you, though, she says. Without my fancy brain, I wouldn't be here right now, says Susan. Here where? Here, let alone right here, able to demand you remove your snow pants. I already said I would, says Carla. You said you would before I was in a position to demand it. This is a confusing courtship, at least in light of what I've read so far, but I know it wouldn't be right unless there were a few feints before revelation. We can't just have everything without complication, you and I. There'd be no story without complications. With nothing to overcome, we die unstoried deaths. My distant cousin invented a new and wholly novel egg dish that is probably extremely delicious, and she can't imagine its immediate success, even though most success, nowadays at least, tends to be immediate. She can't see Eggs Giselle becoming instantly famous. She sees an extended process where the name of the dish changes over a long stretch of time, and respect slowly builds for her, and fame collects at the same turtle's pace, and the Ritz begins serving Eggs Giselle some 10 years down the line, and 10 years later Caesar's Palace and Hotel Nico, and even Spago eventually takes its own stab at the dish, adding rosemary or wasabi or something. And there's a lawsuit over recipe patents or copyrights, which probably don't even exist, but a struggle and a long time and a lot of effort, because if Giselle imagined it otherwise, there'd be nothing to look forward to looking back on. So if without a story, even the fame of an egg dish isn't viable, then how about true love? It would be impossible. What about first sight, says Carla. There's tons of stories about love at first sight. In the good ones, though, says Susan, the love's thwarted by outside forces, and if it isn't, then death comes to one, if not both, of the lovers as soon as the love's consummated. So they never have the chance to betray one another, Carla says. It's merciful. Not entirely, though, says Susan. The one who lives, if one of them lives, ends up struggling to find meaning in a seemingly meaningless... I don't think this will kill you too fast, Susan. Carla lowers her head, kisses Susan's neck. If it doesn't, says Susan, kill you fast, it isn't true. I have a presentation to make in media... Are you dying? Carla says. Yes, please, says Susan. Carla gets off of Susan, removes her snow pants. She doesn't have a big ass at all. You don't have a big ass at all, says Susan. Would you have preferred a big ass, says Carla? I might have, but it doesn't even matter. I'm impossibly dedicated to your true ass. Have you ever had sex with a girl, Susan? No, Carla. I haven't even been kissed by anybody but you and my mom, and those kisses were so long ago, they might not have happened even. Do you want to smoke more opium before we do, to guarantee we're high, says Carla? It'll thwart us sufficiently, I think. When we look back, we'll have to worry about the possibility that it was the drug, rather than love, that allowed for the damn good time we're about to have. We'll have to meet again sober to find out for sure, but we'll smoke more opium then, too, and every time after that, and so we'll continue to worry, and we'll struggle and struggle, thwarted forever. You can't doubt a plan that pretty, can you? Isn't it a pretty plan, says Carla? Yes, Susan says. Chapter 130,031. Not French. Giselle and Susan are on opposite sides of the tiny balcony. A half-tempo electronic rendering of Mozart's Magic Flute is coming through the speakers of the box on the railing. At the end of the overture, Susan says, "Hey, Giselle, can I borrow a cigarette?" "Borrow a cigarette?" says Giselle. "What, are you going to give it back to me when you're done?" Giselle thinks this is awfully funny, when really, it's just stupid fucking banter. On the other hand, Susan knows that one asks not to borrow a cigarette, but rather to bum a cigarette, for precisely the reason Giselle is made salient. Giselle says, "When'd you start smoking fags, anyway?" "This afternoon," Susan says. "How'd you like the eggs?" Giselle says. "They were ungodly," Susan says. "They were not," Giselle says. "I didn't actually get to eat them, but Giselle, let me ask you, in terms of cousinhood, exactly how distant are we?" Giselle extends her arms as far as they'll extend. "No blood," she says. "Wow, your armpits are shaved." "I'm British, Susan. I'm not French." "Neither am I. Fuck. Are you going to inhale on the bloody thing or what?" "What?" Susan says. Giselle demonstrates. Susan mimics, coughs, considers. Her mind twirls at the thought of getting high on opium that never entered her system, at the thought of Adam distinguishing between himself and the world and its future and his own, the thought of a man not yet slated to die thinking to give 70 years away, of how to understand the difference between giving and having while alone and immortal in Eden, how you could mourn the end of something you never had a chance to take for granted. Susan starts to shiver, and she shivers till she shakes, and it doesn't let up when she flops out of her chair. It doesn't let up when her ass hits the floor of the balcony, nor when the impact shocks her spine. Even after the back of her head strikes a corner of her wheelchair's footrest, and even after the back of her head strikes the corner again, and skull pushes in her brain, she doesn't stop shaking, not for a full 7 seconds. The breathy honking that comes from Giselle may sound like weeping, but because she keeps sticking her tongue out and saying things like, "good one," and "jokes up, bloke," and finally, mysteriously, "bungo," her dying cousin concludes it's not weeping. And then her dying cousin is dead. Chapter Susan. Susan. Free-floating 3 feet over the balcony, disembodied Susan is at once alarmed and relieved that Pedro is not there to greet her. The alarm soon dissipates, however, because disembodied Susan is looking at her disem-Susaned body, at her head turned left cheek up, the cigarette she dropped at the start of the shaking burning her hair away, and it is gleefully a shame. Susan knows everything now. She knows, for instance, that while Giselle is crying, she is also silently repeating, "She asked for the fag, I didn't push it on her." And though she can't seem to express it, or anything else, Susan knows for sure that nothing is inexpressible. The hair on the head of the body burns away quickly to reveal a red mark Carla kissed atop a freckle just below Susan's left ear. "How I was pretty, isn't it pretty to think so? How I was pretty to think so," says Susan, thinks Susan, 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 Susaning. The end.